consider was what do I see as the leading philosophy going into the 21st century. I think there's three leading philosophies that are seem to be merging, which is really scary. But as far as philosophers go, I think Nietzsche and Hegel, their thought, it's a big debate about whether whose thought is more important. I tend to see Nietzsche's thought as more important than most philosophers do, but it seems like most philosophers or most thinkers that are dealing with cultural apologetics, whether they know it or not, it seems like their whole works are responding to Nietzsche and God is dead. Nietzsche and Hegel, but then also New Age type philosophy. And so, and it only makes sense, the thought in Germany, theological, philosophical thought is always 40 to 80 years ahead of America and Europe, and they went. That they were the first to experience the gay rights movement in the late 1800s, the neo-paganism, the resurgence of paganism, but they were also rather fond of Nietzsche's thought. Hegel had a big influence on German philosophy as well, so and German theology. So, but basically with Nietzsche. Nietzsche really did not pronounce the death of God. Hegel mentioned that before Nietzsche, but Nietzsche was the first thinker who recognized the consequences of a world without God, and B, decided to proclaim it. And so he said, if God is dead, then absolute truth is dead. If there's no God, there's no truth. And if there's no truth, there's no morality. And he said, well, we need a new myth. The Christian myth carried Western culture this far. Now we need a new myth, a story. Because, you know, when truth is thrown out the window, all that's left are stories. And Nietzsche really, you know, formed the basis for postmodern thought. But I think a postmodern myth isn't strong enough. I think you have to bring paganism back. So I think postmodernism is going to give way to New Age type thought. But whatever the case, when Nietzsche acted like God is dead, truth is dead, morality is dead, and then this will bring about the Superman, a group of men who reject the soft values of Christianity, and create their own hard values and further the human evolution of man and bring in a somewhat of a new age. This isn't going to really create the Superman or the Overman. C.S. Lewis and Schaeffer saw that the death of God, the death of truth, the death of morality will lead to the death of man. Lewis called it the abolition of man. Schaeffer called it the death of man, where man is treated as non-man. Where man even begins to view himself as non-man. An example of that would be Hillary Clinton talking about how she wants to take care of us, you know, with the government-run health care and stuff like that. Well, when you look at what she views as freedom and how she views taking care of us, she wants to give us the same things that we give to our dogs. You own a dog. You give the dog a warm place to sleep. If the dog's fixed, the dog's usually free to go outside and have sex with whatever other dogs they want. You're going to provide food for the dog. Not the most exciting food on earth, but you're going to provide food for the dog, place to sleep. And usually you expect the dog to do something. Like if you get a bigger dog, you expect it to be like somewhat of a watchdog.
Did you read the story of the dog and the chicken?
No.
I think it was a newspaper reporter or an ambassador of America, I can't remember what the interview was called, interviewing Saul and asked him, how can you treat your people like this? You know, your regime is just absolutely ruthless. Saul asked for a chicken to be brought in. They grabbed the chicken by the legs, had it hanging upside down, and pulled its feathers off. And the guy was just aghast, and the chicken was just, you know, screaming in pain and trying to get away until it was completely devoid of feathers. Stalin put it down and asked for some bread. And there is this chicken, all naked and bleeding, still in agony. And Stalin bends down to feed the chicken. The chicken runs back to him and the bread. And he goes, "See, people are like this chicken. You can treat them as bad as you want, as long as you have the bread or give them what you need."
Yeah.
And I was like, wow.
The ancient cry was bread and circuses. The Roman emperors would, as long as they provide people with bread and some form of entertainment through the gladiators or the Roman Colosseum, the circuses, the people wouldn't revolt and wouldn't be so upset with the fact that they were being treated as less than human and their rights were being stepped all over. And today we have bread and circuses. Bread is called welfare, and circuses is any form of entertainment you want, whether it's, you know, the movies, sports, and all that. And those things aren't necessarily bad, but if you keep that unreal world, if you jump into that unreal world of entertainment and diversions to keep you from really standing up against the injustices of your day, then you're no better than the people with the slave mentality of ancient times who cried out for bread and circuses and then allowed the Romans to infringe upon their rights. And so, basically, I see Nietzsche's thought as being real prominent as we enter the 21st century.
The reason the question was also, I was trying to brush up on Nietzsche here, and I came across him that he may have been influenced by some of the Indian works, specifically Madame Blavatsky.
I think it's very clear that Hitler and the Nazis got the swastika from Blavatsky. Nietzsche, there was somewhat of an occultic emphasis to him, but it was very small. So Blavatsky may have had a minor influence on Nietzsche. But it's when people claim that the Nazis, like Norman Geisler, acts like the Nazis, their views can be traced directly to Nietzsche. No, Nietzsche was an afterthought to the Nazis. They had some similar views, but the Nazis got their views from Blavatsky of the Theosophical Society and the resurgence of ancient paganism, which Blavatsky was all about. So, but to give it some intellectual, an air of intellectual flavor, the Nazis turned to Nietzsche. Now, I'm not saying, you know, therefore Nietzsche wasn't that bad. He wasn't anti-Semitic, but as far as I'm concerned, once you throw absolute morality out the window, you've opened the door for anti-Semites. So, but whatever the case, I don't think Blavatsky had anywhere near the influence over Nietzsche that she had over the Nazis.
Okay.
The Nazi movement was heavily influenced by her, even to the point of the Great White Brotherhood, the perfect Aryan male. They got the whole concept of the Aryans from her. The anti-Semitism, the occultism, all that came from Blavatsky. With Nietzsche, he was one of the few atheists that realized, okay, there is no God, and I'm happy because I can do as I please. At the same time, I'm very sad because now we have no meaning to life, no basis for truth, no basis for morality, and everybody just have, all my atheist colleagues are having a good old time, and they don't realize that it is like we stepped off a cliff and we're standing in midair, and we think we're not going to fall. Now, he saw the 20th century, predicted the 20th century would be the bloodiest century in the history of mankind, and he was right. But he thought that would be the growing pains, the birthing pains that would bring forth the Superman. Instead, it would, from a Christian standpoint, if C.S. Lewis and Francis Schaeffer are correct, and I think they are, it's just the tip of the iceberg. So more are going to be slaughtered. Now, with Hegel, you had the thesis, the antithesis, maybe even several antitheses, contradictory ideas but being synthesized into new truth. So there is no absolute truth in Hegel's thought, but we're moving towards absolute truth. And the absolute spirit, this impersonal God, is actually unfolding itself through history. And that brings with it not only a denial of absolute truth in Hegel's dialectic, but it also brings with it the deification of the state, because as far as Hegel was concerned, the impersonal God was unfolding itself in history, and the present stage was the state, so the state could be deified, so Hitler could be worshipped. But you have the deification of the state, so I mean, this could bring back emperor worship. Even Nietzsche saying we need to bring back some new myth, and he talked highly about the ancient myths. But I think even with Nietzsche and Hegel, it's too dry for the common man, and both Hegel and Nietzsche's thought is not spiritual enough for the average human, common man or not. And so with the rejection of God, with the rejection of truth, with the rejection of morality, and man still longing for meaning in life, since man doesn't live on bread alone, I think the New Age movement, but I think the driving forces are going to be Nietzschean philosophy and Hegelian philosophy, but it's going to have to give way to something like the New Age movement. But the New Age movement has brought too much embarrassment with it. So it's going to have to be called neo-spirituality or, third wave, such and such. But they're basically going to have to give it a new name, because nobody wants to. Mikhail Gorbachev is right now proclaiming a real heavy New Age message, hyper-environmentalism. To save the planet, we need international laws about the environment and that type of thing. And if your business puts enough smoke in the air, you're guilty of global terrorism and that type of thing. But Gorbachev would, real high up in the United Nations circles, he'd be embarrassed to associate himself with Shirley MacLaine. So there's got to be a kind of an intellectually respectful type of version of the New Age movement. But what that will allow is, just as in ancient Rome, you can worship any of the gods you choose so long as you say Caesar is Lord as well. As long as the emperor is one of your gods. And of course, Christians can only say Jesus is Lord. And in the Christians, that was one of the most ancient Christian creeds. Jesus is Lord. Paul quotes it in Romans 10. He also quotes it in 1 Corinthians 12. But probably goes back to the 30s A.D. But even about 30 years before Christ walked the earth, the Roman emperors were already being spoken of as being deified. The past Roman emperor was being referred to as a god, so that the present Roman emperor was being viewed as a son of God. And so the Caesar is Lord was considered, was becoming more and more widespread. And in the midst of this, it's like Francis Schaeffer pointed out, that Christians were not put to death because they worshiped Jesus. They were put to death because they worshiped Jesus alone. They refused to worship Jesus and Caesar. And so you can see that the door is opening for a global government where all mankind is God. It's just that the emperor, the world ruler, manifests God a little bit stronger than others. So just as Hitler could be worshipped. And by the way, when you look at the training of Hitler's youth and the training of his troops, they spoke about Hitler as God, as deity, and worshipped him. And yet it was more of a pantheistic, that all Aryans were divine. And I think we're going to see that with the Antichrist. But whatever the case, I think it's some kind of blend of Hegelian. But see, Hegelianism, just because all history is moving towards somewhat of an omega point, he wouldn't use those words. But that in itself is very close to New Age type thinking. It's sure it's lacking in some of the ritualistic or spiritualistic aspects, but I think some type of blending of Nietzsche, Hegel, and New Age type thought is what lies ahead, which is going to spell the slaughter of billions if Western culture doesn't repent, turn back to the God of the Bible, or at least biblical morality. Okay, we're still talking about truth and knowledge. You see, basically what we've done so far in this course of study, we've refuted fideism, the idea that you just believe, with by leap of blind faith, the idea that Christianity is something you believe with the heart and the will, but the mind has no place. It goes against reason. We've refuted fideism. We've given the biblical basis for apologetics, for defending the faith. We talked about some of the different ways we could defend the faith, different branches, different methodologies. And then we got into epistemology. And basically, what we're doing is we're trying to deal with the question of truth. Does absolute truth exist? And then secondly, if it does, can man know truth? Because if we answer those questions in the negative, there is no absolute truth, or maybe there's absolute truth but man can't know it, then there's no sense in doing apologetics. And so these are rather foundational. Now, I believe last week, the last time we got together, we talked a little bit about Francis Schaeffer and some of his thought there. I mentioned that in my book, No Other God, The Defense of Biblical Christianity, Truth and Knowledge, there's a chapter on that in that book. This is becoming more and more important because of postmodernism, the rejection, which entails the rejection of absolute truth. So I just want to talk a little bit about Gordon Clark. Gordon Clark was a presuppositionalist. He rejected traditional apologetics. He believed that unaided human reason cannot arrive at truths about God. And I agree with him on that point, but I don't think I would go as far as he went. Okay? It's interesting, too. He held to a view his epistemology, his theory of knowledge. Now, the later Clark changed his views, and he ended up with a view called scripturalism, where the only thing we could know, we would be should be skeptical about everything except what the Bible teaches. The problem with that was when he was in his 80s and about to die, he was telling his followers who were mathematicians to try to find the axioms of geometry in the Bible, to try to find, because there's so many things that we know are true, but they're not in the Bible. They're not taught in the Bible. So if the only truth we can find, I mean, how can you know, how could Gordon Clark know that Gordon Clark exists if he's not listed in the Bible? Okay, so how could you know there's a chair that's that you're sitting on right now that's not listed in the Bible? So Clark's later view was very, very weak. But his earlier view of knowledge really had something to be really something we should think about, give some really good thought to, because the view was they call it preformation, that God preformed the categories of our mind so that they are consistent with the way reality is, reality as it is, so that we could really find out about the world in which we live. It's really interesting, though, with Clark taking that type of epistemology, that starting point, that our minds can find truth because God created our mind. The way Clark put it, and I quote, "God has fashioned both the mind and the world so that they harmonize." So that God basically put innate ideas in our minds that do correspond to reality. And Clark would argue that without presupposing God, Kant's dilemma would remain. Kant argued that man could know reality as it appears to us, but not reality as it is. It's kind of like, I don't have this table in my mind, I have an idea of this table in my mind. Kind of like a photograph of this table in my mind. Well, how do I know it's an accurate depiction of the table? Simple. I just take that photograph that's in my mind of the table and I compare it with the table. What's the problem there? I don't really ever get the table, I just get another photo of the table. Okay? So, man is forever damned to the world of appearances. He could only know reality as it appears to him, not reality as it is. Immanuel Kant's view there, it was so powerful. And by the way, all it is a footnote on what David Hume said before him. And David Hume was an empiricist. He believed truth could only be found through the five senses, and because of that, his philosophy was skeptic. It ended in skepticism. Okay? And but Kant spelled out even more clearly that man could only know reality as it appeared to him, not reality as it is. Okay? Now, Hegel's reputation of Kant was that, well, is that statement a statement about reality as it is? Or is it a statement about reality as it appears to us? Because if it's a statement, if it's only a statement about how reality appears to us, who cares? But if it's a statement about reality as it is, then Kant's view is self-refuting. Now, unfortunately, Hegel's still seeing the problem with empirical data of the world of the five senses, just threw the world of the five senses out the window. Hegel was an idealist. All that exists are ideas. But whatever the case, Clark, I would say that to a certain degree, almost all the philosophy that has been done, kind of the cutting-edge philosophy that has been done for the last two centuries, is just pretty much a response to Kant. That's how powerful his views were. Two Christians that responded to Kant in the same way, Gordon Clark and Stuart Hackett, two philosophers, both writing in the 1950s, although Clark wrote even earlier than that as well, but both of them came... accepted what Kant believed he had refuted, although both of these philosophers said that they refute Kant's reputation, but they both held to the preformation theory that God implanted in our minds categories or innate ideas that do correspond to reality. So even though we don't know all the particulars in how we know what we know, we can know that we know reality as it is. Well, what it amounts to is the existence. Clark would argue the existence of the God of the Bible guarantees that we can know reality as it is. My only problem with Clark on that point is I guess you could classify me as a theistic presuppositionalist, but not a Christian presuppositionalist. What I mean by that is that man's reason works and finds truth as it is, finds reality as it is, I think, presupposes the existence of a rational God. It presupposes the existence of a personal God. It presupposes theism, but not necessarily that God is triune, not necessarily that God wrote the Bible. Now, I think that we can provide very strong arguments for that later on. Yeah, but I mean, I you know, now the thing is, though, with both of these guys, I agree with Hackett and Clark that God did form the human mind and the categories of human thought, the preconditions for human thought, and he formed reality as it is as well, so that we can really know reality as it is. I agree with Clark and I on that, but Clark believed that closed the door on traditional apologetics. Hackett believed that that opened the door to traditional apologetics, and I agree with Hackett on that point, that that opens the door so that we can bring back traditional arguments for God's existence, because the supposed refutations of the arguments for God's existence, traditional arguments for God's existence, are all based on human Kant, and so if we can refute them, we bring it back. That's why Hackett's work was titled The Resurrection of Theism. Okay, so, but whatever the case, if you look at point number two, Clark rejected empiricism. First off, the idea that truth can only be found through the five senses, that's the most radical and empirical view that you can hold. Aquinas was not. Aquinas was an empiricist, but not the extreme sense. The extreme sense would say that truth can only be found through the five senses. Well, what's wrong with that? Yeah, and that statement itself, if that statement's supposed to be a truth, truth is found only through the five senses, but you can't find that truth through the five senses. So,
more than five senses.
Yeah, it's just, yeah. And so it's a self-refuting statement. And in fact, you mentioned, unless there's more than five senses, that's the whole extrasensory perception, acting like there's at least another sixth sense and all. The reason why Christians recognize that as being in the world of the occult is because what they're doing is they're just trying to say the spiritual, they're referring to the spiritual aspect of man and the existence of spiritual entities besides man. They're acting like that's an extra sense, a natural sense, when in actuality you're entering into the supernatural realm and it's the spiritual realm. But as far as the realm of the senses go, the verification principle, which dominated the first half of the 20th century, said that it was from the school of thought called logical positivism. Bertrand Russell was part of that, A.J. Ayres. They said that a statement can only be meaningful if it's either proven by the five senses or if it's a tautology. In other words, if it's self-defined. Like a bachelor, by definition, is an unmarried male. So we know that that is true. But the thing is, it doesn't tell us whether Joe Schmo is a bachelor or not. So, in the end, when you take away all the things that contain within themselves their own definition, like the laws of logic, the laws of mathematics, and all, verification principle leaves us with the only meaningful statements or statements that can be proven through the five senses. But the problem was the verification principle itself could not be proven through the five senses, and it took about 40 or 50 years. Gordon Clark was one of the first thinkers to recognize that and put that in writing, but because he was a Christian author, it was virtually ignored until non-Christian writers started saying the same thing. But whatever the case, so that strict empiricism is just, as are most reductionist views, views that reduce everything to one thing, you'll find very few strict empiricists as far as among real thinking individuals today. But Clark would even be opposed to an empiricist like Thomas Aquinas. And I, by the way, I would oppose Aquinas on this point. I like Aquinas' argumentation. Clark does not. But I would agree with Clark that Aquinas' epistemology, being Aristotelian, being an empiricist view of knowledge, I would agree with Clark that it was erroneous at the base. I would just argue that his epistemology is not an essential foundation to his later thought. Okay, that you can go with an Augustinian Platonic, more rational starting point, and still use the same type of arguments. But Aquinas was an empiricist in that he believed that everything in the mind was first in the senses except the mind itself. In other words, Aquinas was arguing that we start our lives as blank slates, but God has given our minds the ability to take from sense perception, to take data from our sense experiences, okay, and to draw rational conclusions from that. Now, I would agree with Gordon Clark, no matter how much reasoning you do, you're never going to get moral values from a mound of dirt. Okay, so I think empiricism, when you throw out innate ideas, the fact that God has implanted in our minds innate ideas, they don't, I believe they're subconscious or unconscious ideas. We don't become conscious of them they're until we have sense experiences, okay? But the fact of the matter is, you know, it's just like the empiricist would argue that we get our concept equality by examining two equal things, and that's where we come up with it. I would argue with the rationalist that we had to have the idea of equality first, so that when we see two things of equal size, it triggers that idea, but it's not there in the sense experience. We have to have that concept of equality that we bring in. And just like if you're doing math and you add 1 + 1 and you come up with 3, the rational idea that 1 + 1 = 2 comes into the situation and stands in judgment on that. And I think that there are concepts like equality that are part of the packaging of the human mind. But Aquinas really attacked this idea that we could start with the senses. And he said, no, you know, and the thing is, too, is the Bible teaches that God created us in His image. So if God created us in His image, that would seem to entail Romans 2:14-15, that God's moral laws were written on our hearts, not on a mound of dirt, and then we drew it out of the mound of dirt. We were born with those ideas. We didn't become conscious of them till later on, but those ideas are innate to being human. And that's part of being created in God's image, not being a blank slate. So his problems with empiricism, he zeroed in not just on the radical empiricist, but also anybody who tries to start their knowledge, start human knowledge, the starting point of human knowledge, if they make it, the realm of the senses. He attacks that positions. He argued that rational conclusions cannot be drawn from sense experience alone. Okay? I mean, just think about it. Just to say this chair, for me to have a sense experience of this chair and know that this chair is this chair, entails me also, since this other chair is in part of my sense experience, means that I have to know that this particular chair is not that particular chair. Right there, you've got two laws of logic, the law of identity, being is being, or A equals A, and also the law of non-contradiction, A cannot equal non-A at the same time in the same way. So you know, this chair is this chair, and it is not that chair. So just to get a real knowledge of this chair takes more, and Aquinas would agree, but Aquinas would say we're getting that, those rational ideas from the sense experience. Clark is saying no. It was already there in your mind, and it may be brought to the forefront through the sense experience, but you're not drawing it from the sense experience. So rational conclusions cannot be drawn from sense experience alone. Clark. This is where Clark began to get radical, though. He denied the basic reliability of sense perception. I think when Jesus showed himself alive to the apostles, he was telling them, he was assuming, presupposing, the basic reliability of sense perception so that they would see that he had bodily risen from the dead, and then they would trust in him as the being victorious over death. If Clark is correct, I don't know, Jesus was playing games or something, because how could you have physical evidence for the resurrection if we can't draw anything from the five senses at all? He even considered induction a fallacy, which means if you argue from the particulars to the whole, he saw that as he believed the only way you can reason rightly is through deduction. Argue from universals to particulars rather than arguing from particulars to universals. Whenever we deal with empiricism, we're from the world of the senses, we're arguing from particulars to universals. All the particulars we've examined in the universe are limited and dependent, so we assume the whole universe is limited and dependent. Clark would say that's a fallacy. Only if we knew the whole universe was dependent first would we know that all the individual factors are. So I would say that, you know, well, in philosophy, the class, they teach you that if you know a universal premise, okay, a universal premise would be like this, something like this: everything in the universe is finite. Everything in the physical universe is finite, is limited. Okay? So, since we start with a universal, we can deduce things from that. So we can deduce, okay, if everything in the universe is limited, Phil Fernandez is part of the physical universe, therefore Phil Fernandez is limited.
And all of that we can deduce by empirical evidence also.
Well,
by seeing beings that are finite,
the thing is, though, your first premise you can never get with fallibility from empiricism.
You're using empiricism as a tool to enforce that.
Yeah, well, what empiricism would argue in the other direction.
Oh.
And deduction, you get the universal right at the outset. Okay? And for instance, the Bible tells us heaven and earth will pass away, but my words will not pass away. So the Bible tells us that the whole universe is limited and finite, okay? But you see that when they teach you in a logic class, when you argue from a universal to a particular, if you have a sound argument, such as everything in the universe is finite, Phil Fernandez is a thing in the universe, therefore Phil Fernandez is finite, that means the conclusion must necessarily be true. If your premises are true and you're using a deductive argument, arguing from the universal to a particular, and it's a sound argument and all your premises are true, the conclusion must necessarily be true. Now, induction, okay, said that if you argue from a particular to a universal, okay, you can only deal with probability. Okay? For instance, induction. Socrates is a man. Premise number two, man is mortal. Therefore, now our conclusion, all men are mortal. That's a very weak, that has very low probability because we've all have, you know, there's billions of humans on alive right now, and billions of humans that have lived throughout all time, and all we looked at was one guy, one particular, and because he died, we're saying everybody's going to die. Okay? A very strong inductive argument there would be every human that has ever lived long enough, or every human who was born before 1850 has died. Okay? Therefore, every human born after 1850 will someday die. Okay, that has a very high degree of probability because now we look at a lot more people than Socrates. Okay? But can you see how when you use an inductive argument, arguing from the particular to the whole, all you get is a degree of probability. It's a probabilistic argument. Whereas if you start with the whole, such as all men are mortal, Socrates is a man, therefore Socrates is mortal, that conclusion is necessarily true if those premises are true. So with a deduction, you get certainty. So what Clark is saying is, if your conclusion carries less than certainty, it's not real knowledge. So Clark is like, he's in a different camp, okay? Anything outside of deductive reasoning, he just doesn't allow. So there is an ultra-rationalistic bent to Clark, even though Clark does attack rationalism. We're going to see that in just a minute. Let me say this too about inductive arguments. If you do have access to the whole set, then an inductive argument would carry the same weight as a deductive argument. In other words, if we knew that, and this is not true, just looking in this room, but if we knew that every chair in this room was blue, okay, we could argue this chair in the room is blue. That chair A is blue, chair B is blue, chair C is blue, chair D is blue. Well, if there's only four chairs in the room, then we can conclude, therefore, all the chairs in the room are blue. That goes beyond probability. Now you've got certainty because we have examined we have seen the entire set. Okay? At the same time, you could take that same argument and turn it around and make it a deductive argument and say all the chairs in the room are blue. Chair B is a chair in the room, therefore it is blue. Okay? All the cars in my driveway are blue. Okay? Would be an. But when you deal with a universal that there's no way of examining it all at once, if you're human, then inductive arguments can only deal with a conclusion that's probable, not necessary. Well, Clark throws out probabilistic arguments. He won't accept them. And one of my refutations on him in my doctoral dissertation, a chapter was devoted to him, which I put that chapter, I broke it down, and put it in the No Other Gods, and one of the appendixes is that, let me see if I can...
hardcore rock solid